oxytocin, an imbalance of endorphins. Stephen M. Edelson suggested several syndromes before giving up and quipping, "I diagnose him as a hermit." "Nothing makes complete sense," said Derry. "The complexity of this guy is so puzzling, you could go anywhere, diagnostically. There has to be grandiosity to go through with a plan like that. It is so exceptional. Knight is like a Rorschach card. He really is an object for everyone to project onto." Knight expressed little interest in his diagnosis. "I only learned about Asperger's here in jail. It's just a label slapped on a set of behaviors." He admitted that therapy might benefit him, but was adamant that any disorder assigned to him not be used as an excuse for his crimes. He said he was taking no medications. "I don't want to be in the position of victim. It's not my nature. There's not much, from what I've read, that I can do about my diagnosis. I don't think I'll be a spokesman for the Asperger's telethon." "Do they still do telethons?" "I hate Jerry Lewis." Chapter 20. The cabin owners of North Pond, a majority of them, arrived at a very different diagnosis. Knight was not just a thief, they said, but also a fraud. "No way he's telling the truth," declared Fred King, who once had a sugar bowl stolen from his place, after which, for years, his friends called him Sugar Bowl. "Can I use a swear word?" asked King, gruff and polite at once, a very main trait. "There is no fucking way this guy was a hermit. I'm an outdoorsman, and I'm just telling you flat out, no way. I'm 1,000% sure. In winter, it's sub-zero all the time. I think a family member helped him, or another person took him in, or he broke into a vacant place and stayed all winter." Some people refused to accept that Knight had never once required medical care. Food stored in the woods, others noted, inevitably attracts raccoons and coyotes, which will tear your camp apart. "And how was it possible," a couple of locals asked, "that Knight could speak so well, that his vocal cords still functioned, and he'd retained such an extensive vocabulary if he really hadn't used his voice for so long?" One resident pointed out that there was a road called Knight Court not far from his site, and a Knight family, likely relatives of Chris's, had lived there forever. They must have provided assistance. Also, if Knight had really been out there, the great ice storm of 1998 would surely have frozen him. "Everything that came from his camp stunk," said Steve Treadwell, the pine tree employee who'd observed the police interrogation of Knight and the dismantling of his site. "But he was clean-smelling. He didn't live in the woods. His story doesn't pass the smell test, literally." Dozens of North Pond summer residents offered their opinions about Knight, and about 80% of them insisted that he was lying, such an overwhelming preponderance that the only proper thing to do was ask Knight directly. Did he truly spend 27 years alone in the woods? Or did he have assistance, or pass the winter in a cabin, or at least use someone's bathroom? When questioned, Knight was adamant and a little angry. Other than the one time he stayed in a home during the first few weeks of his escape, he never again slept inside. "I had no help from anybody, ever." He was not in touch with his family. He did not take a shower, nap in a bed, or lounge on someone's sofa, even for a minute. The first time he used an actual toilet in a quarter century was in the Kennebec County Jail. When he was driven to the jail in the back of a squad car, it was the first time he'd ridden in an automobile since abandoning the brat. "I'm a thief. I induced fear. People have a right to be angry. But I have not lied." Knight seemed entirely honest, practically incapable of lying, a notion that several other people supported. Diane Vance said that much of her job as a state trooper consisted of sorting through lies people fed her, but with Knight, she had no questions. Unequivocally, she said, I believe him. Sergeant Hughes felt the same. There's no doubt in my mind he's lived out there the whole time. There was not a morsel of convincing evidence that Knight had ever spent an evening away from the woods, minus the one occasion he admitted to, an admission that itself was a sign of his precise honesty. He said that he didn't need medical care because he wasn't exposed to germs. He kept his food sealed in plastic totes and remained in camp nearly all the time. Most large animals won't approach when a human is present. At the time of his arrest, after a long winter, he was down to a single set of unsoiled clothes. He was due for a laundry day. Even in the cold, he kept himself clean with sponge baths, preferably using a large yellow car wash sponge, if he could steal one, and he frequently took shower gel and deodorant. He could speak so well because vocal cords do not, in fact, curl up and die with disuse, and speaking in complex sentences isn't about the mouth, it comes from the brain, which in Knight's case was fully operational, albeit idiosyncratic. Knight had no idea that a family of Knights lived nearby, and anyway, they're not related. His surname is common in central Maine. He wished there had been more great ice storms. Ice is nearly liquid. You don't have liquid in serious cold, in killing cold. It was 28 degrees during that storm. In a car, driving, it was serious. For me, it was a novelty. Actually, it helped. It put a thick layer of ice over the snow, and I could walk around without leaving tracks. Most of the North Pond locals, when they were informed that Knight's story was undoubtedly true, did not change their minds. They were convinced that Knight was running some bizarre con, and that all who believed him had fallen into his trap. They didn't reject his story mildly, they rejected it venomously. A few seemed less angry about having their goods stolen than the fact that Knight's tale was accepted by anyone. They couldn't get their heads around Knight. It was as if he'd insisted that he could flap his arms and fly. His story was both true and unbelievable at the same time. An unsettling merger. The locals were rattled because Knight's feat went against all that felt natural, was antithetical to nearly everything one learns. In the Bible, in chapter 2 of Genesis, Adam's aloneness is the first thing God finds objectionable. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone." One reason there are virtually no more devout Christian solitaries, and haven't been since the 1700s, is that they frightened the ecclesiastical authorities. Hermits were unsupervised thinkers, pondering life and death and God, and the church, with its ingrained schedules and rote memorization, did not approve of many hermits' ideas. Thomas Aquinas, the 13th-century Italian priest, said hermits could be subversive to obedience and stability, and that it was better to keep such people in monasteries, subject to regulations and routine. The solitary is necessarily a man who does what he wants to do, wrote Thomas Merton, an American Trappist monk who died in 1968. In fact, he has nothing else to do. That is why his vocation is both dangerous and despised. I began asking cabin owners, and later many others, to estimate the longest time they'd ever spent without human interaction. By this I meant not seeing anyone or communicating in any way, including phone, email, or text messages. Just time by oneself, unconnected, though reading or listening to the radio or watching TV alone was okay. 9 out of 10 people, often after a contemplative pause, realized that they had never passed a single day in solitude. Usually it was no more than a handful of waking hours. My father has lived 73 years, but hasn't tried a dozen hours alone. I once embarked on a 3-day solo wilderness trip, but encountered a pair of hikers and stopped to chat, so my record is around 48 hours. A few accomplished explorers I know have gone a week. To meet someone who's finished a month would be extraordinary. Chris Knight, with his thousands upon thousands of days alone, was an unfathomable outlier. His feat goes so far beyond anyone else's physical or mental limit that it rearranges our notion of the possible. But the truth is that Knight was out there every one of those winters, and what he did in the cold was both prosaic and profound. He suffered. When he ran out of propane and food, he often became cold, cold, really cold. Such cold is often called mind-numbing, but he was aware of it, always. He called it physical, emotional, psychological pain. His body fat was eaten from within, his stomach begged. He sensed the nearness of death. Yet he refused to light a fire or leave a traceable footprint. When the situation passed some point of dire, he monitored the weather reports on the radio and waited for a snowstorm to approach. With the exception of a few year-round homes, which Knight never touched, the area was mostly deserted in winter, and he knew which seasonal cabins likely still had food. With the last of his energy, he'd slog through the forest, cut across the frozen pond, hit one of these cabins, and return as the flakes started to fall, erasing his tracks. He could not always maintain an impassive neutrality. Sometimes a tiny thing wormed into the deep spot where he'd stashed his emotions. Once, as he was listening to the radio, a blizzard swirling around him, the school closures were announced. His old high school was mentioned. Just a moment on the radio, but it brought back a flood of memories, and Knight felt his chest clench with melancholy. How had his life come to this? He occasionally missed his family. I suppose a more subtle answer would be, I missed some of my family, to a certain degree, he allowed. For long stretches, family didn't exist in his thoughts. Then a memory would be triggered, and they'd be alive in his head. He missed his sister, Susanna, the most. She's the sibling closest in age to Knight, a year younger, and has Down syndrome. She was the one I spent most of my childhood with, he said. There were times, he admitted, when he wept, but he provided no further details. Sporadically, especially during the first decade, the idea of quitting his seclusion entered his mind. He had a system in place. He kept a whistle in his tent, and if he ever became too weak to move, he knew that if he blew on it in sustained sequences of 3, the high-pitched sounds would carry across the water, and help might eventually come. After a while, though, he resolved that he wouldn't use the whistle. He made a firm decision that he was not going to voluntarily emerge from the trees. Civilization was 3 minutes away. But he never went except to steal. I was prepared to die out there, he said. Chapter 21 A thousand poets sing of solitude. Let me live unseen, unknown, yearned Alexander Pope. But far more people curse it. The difference between bliss and distress generally seems to be whether solitude is chosen or involuntary. Forced isolation is one of the oldest known punishments. Banishment was widely used during the Roman Empire. The poet Ovid was exiled from Rome in A.D. 8, possibly for writing obscene verse. And for centuries, a severe penalty on the high seas was marooning, in which an offending sailor was deposited on an uninhabited island, sometimes with a Bible and a bottle of rum. Most such men were never heard from again. Even now, when a Jehovah's Witness is disfellowshipped for breaking church doctrine, every member of the religion is forbidden from speaking to the sinner. The worst non-lethal punishment in the United States penal system is solitary confinement. "It's a hell all to yourself," said Robert Stark, who has spent years in solitary at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, serving time for murder. Thomas Silverstein killed a prison guard in 1983, and since then, except for 1 week during a prison riot, has been locked alone in a concrete and steel box, during which he has never once felt an affectionate touch. "It feels as if he's been buried alive," Silverstein wrote, "for an entire lifetime." Todd Ashker, who was isolated in a windowless supermax cell for about 25 years, described his situation as a continuous silent screaming. John Catanzarite spent nearly 14 years in solitary in a California prison and said that when he started to lose his sanity, he was glad because it might release him from the horror of reality. After 10 days in solitary confinement, many prisoners display clear signs of mental harm, and one study showed that about a third will eventually develop active psychosis. There are at least 80,000 such inmates in America. The United Nations has determined that holding a person in isolation for more than 15 days is cruel and inhuman punishment. "It's an awful thing, solitary," wrote John McCain, who spent more than 5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, two of them alone, before he became a U.S. senator. "It crushes your spirit," McCain added. "The onset of despair is immediate." A large majority of men, and 25% of women, a University of Virginia study found, would rather subject themselves to mild electric shocks than do nothing but sit quietly with their thoughts for 15 minutes. Unless you are a trained meditator, the study's authors concluded, the mind does not like to be alone with itself. Terry Anderson, kidnapped in Lebanon in 1985 and held mostly alone for more than 6 years, said, "I would rather have had the worst companion than no companion at all." Many evolutionary biologists believe that early humans thrived, despite being weaker and slower than other animals, chiefly due to their superior ability to work together. Human brains are wired to connect. Magnetic resonance imaging shows that the same neural circuitry that causes us to feel physical pain is activated when we face social pain, like being shunned from a group or picked last on the playground. Harry Harlow, a psychology professor at the University of Wisconsin, ran a series of experiments starting in the 1950s, showing that young rhesus monkeys, when isolated from other monkeys for as little as 3 months, could be behaviorally damaged for life. Brain scans of war prisoners in the former Yugoslavia demonstrated that without sustained social interaction, a brain can become as injured as one that has incurred a traumatic blow. Upon being taken captive, John McCain had 2 broken arms and a broken leg, and later developed chronic dysentery. But the pain of loneliness, he implied, was worse. Our inherent and environmentally stimulated sociability may have made our brains grow so large in the first place. Reading and interpreting social cues, noted social neuroscientist John Cacioppo, is, for any of us, at any time, a demanding and cognitively complex activity. The need to recognize the constantly shifting status of friends and foes, to act for the betterment of a group when it isn't in your immediate self-interest, to understand how to reason and cajole and deceive, likely gave rise to an expanded cerebral cortex, which, in turn, resulted in the dominance of humans. Further, evolution selected genes that reinforce pleasure and safety in company, and unease and fear when alone. Unwanted loneliness makes you sick. Social isolation is as damaging as high blood pressure, obesity, or smoking as a risk factor for illness and early death. Happiness for a member of the human species demands connection, wrote Cacioppo. Our brains and bodies are designed to function in aggregates, not in isolation. Connectivity and cooperation transcend humans. These traits extend to the most ancient forms of life. Many animals display extreme devotion to group bonding and social good. There are hives, flocks, herds, schools, gaggles, troops, packs, bands, bevies, coveys, and droves. There are also lone wolves and solitary apes and even hermit-like wasps, but these are exceptions to the general rule of the animal kingdom. Salmonella bacteria work together, secreting signaling molecules that help them determine the opportune moment to collectively attack a host. By the time a human infant is 8 months old, attachments to others have already been formed. It's only Knight and his fellow solitaries throughout history who are puzzling anomalies. After his arrest and incarceration, Knight craved solitary confinement. I have a hope, wish, fantasy of a cell of my own, he wrote in one of his letters. And to think this would be considered punishment, it is to laugh. But not aloud. Knight always made sure to laugh silently, internally. He worried that if he were seen grinning in jail, amused by a thought in his head, it would be considered further proof of his feeble-mindedness. For his first several months in jail, Knight had a cellmate with whom he scarcely exchanged a word. When he was finally transferred to a single cell, he was much relieved. Isolation is the raw material of greatness. Being alone is hazardous to our health. Few other conditions produce such diametrically opposing reactions, though of course genius and craziness often share a fence line. Sometimes even voluntary solitude can send a person over to the wrong side of the fence. In 1988, a cave explorer named Véronique Le Guin volunteered for an extreme experiment, to live alone in an underground cavern in southern France without a clock for 111 days, monitored by scientists who wished to study the human body's natural rhythms in the absence of time cues. For a while, she settled into a pattern of 30 hours awake and 20 hours asleep. She described herself as being psychologically completely out of phase, where I no longer know what my values are or what is my purpose in life. When she returned to society, her husband later noted, she seemed to have an emptiness inside her that she was unable to fully express. While I was alone in my cave, I was my own judge, she said. You are your own most severe judge. You must never lie, or all is lost. The strongest sentiment I brought out of the cave is that in my life I will never tolerate lying. A little more than a year later, Le Guin swallowed an overdose of barbiturates and lay down in her car in Paris, a suicide at age 33. It was a risk that came with this experiment to become half crazy, she'd reportedly said on a radio show 2 days earlier. The first solo around-the-world sailing race, the Golden Globe, began in 1968. Bernard Moitessier of France was on his way to winning when he realized that he loved being alone on his boat and dreaded returning to the hubbub of society. He quit the race after 7 months and continued sailing for nearly a complete second lap of the world, achieving a personal victory he found far more meaningful than any contest. "I am free, free as never before," he wrote. But another competitor in the Golden Globe, Donald Crowhurst of Great Britain, became increasingly lonely and depressed, began radioing false reports about his progress, and finally retreated to his cabin, where he composed a lengthy and hallucinatory treatise. Then he went overboard. His body was never recovered. "It is finished. It is finished. It is the mercy," were some of his final written words. The same solitude, that of the enormous emptiness of the ocean, moved Moitessier to ecstasy and drove Crowhurst to insanity. Night had within him, it seemed, a little of both sailors, a dark side and a light, a yin of winter and a yang of summer. "Pain and pleasure," he called it. Both were essential, he believed, and one could not exist without the other. "Suffering is such a deep part of living," wrote Robert Cull, who lived alone on an island in Patagonia for a year in 2001, "that if we try too hard to avoid it, we end up avoiding life entirely." The Tao Te Ching says that happiness rests in misery. Man is sometimes extraordinarily, passionately in love with suffering, wrote Dostoevsky in Notes from the Underground. Suffering is the sole origin of consciousness. Jill Hooley, the Harvard psychology professor who felt that Knight's behavior displayed characteristics of schizoid personality disorder, observed that torment was the price Knight paid in order to remain in the woods. He was afflicted by cold and hunger, by fear during each break-in, by the guilt of knowing that what he was doing was wrong. His very existence was threatened throughout the winter. "It's an incredibly steep price to pay," said Hooley, "but he was clearly willing to pay it." However acute, his distress was preferable to the alternative, returning to society. Therefore, Hooley concluded, Knight must have received some tremendous benefit for himself, psychologically, from being separated from the world. Many of Knight's most cherished and intense experiences in the woods, he said, were close to his most horrific. In the dead of winter, there was not a rustling leaf, not a candle flick of wind, not a bug or bird. The forest was locked in arctic silence. This was what he craved. "What I miss most in the woods," Knight said, "is somewhere in between quiet and solitude. What I miss most is stillness." To reach this pristine state, the forest hard frozen and the animals bunkered, he had to bring himself to the brink of death. It was only when he heard the song of the chickadees, the state bird of Maine, that he knew winter would soon loosen its grip, that the end was near. The feeling, he said, was momentous. He referred to it as a celebration, the chirps volleying through the trees, the little birds with their black-capped heads bobbing in the bare branches, calling their own names, chickadee-dee, the sound of months of mute suffering coming to a close, the sound of survival. If he still had some fat left on his body, he was proud. Most times, he did not. "After a bad winter," Knight said, "all I could think was that I'm alive." Chapter 22. Snow melted, flowers bloomed, insects droned, deer bred. Years passed, or minutes. "I lost grasp of time," Knight said. "Years were meaningless. I measured time by the season and moon. The moon was the minute hand, the seasons the hour hand. Thunder cracked, ducks flew, squirrels gathered, snow fell. Knight said that he couldn't accurately describe what it felt like to spend such an immense period of time alone. Silence does not translate into words. And he feared that if he tried a translation, he'd come across as a fool. Or even worse, as spouting off phony wisdom or little koans. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, wrote that nothing can be expressed about solitude that has not already been said better by the wind in the pine trees. What happened to him in the woods, Knight claimed, was inexplicable. But he agreed to set aside his fear of phony wisdom and koans and give it a try. "It's complicated," he said. "Solitude bestows an increase in something valuable. I can't dismiss that idea. Solitude increased my perception. But here's the tricky thing. When I applied my increased perception to myself, I lost my identity. There was no audience, no one to perform for. There was no need to define myself. I became irrelevant." The dividing line between himself and the forest, Knight said, seemed to dissolve. His isolation felt more like a communion. "My desires dropped away. I didn't long for anything. I didn't even have a name. To put it romantically, I was completely free." Virtually everyone who has written about deep solitude has said some version of the same thing. When you're alone, your awareness of time and boundaries grows fuzzy. "All distances, all measures," wrote Rainer Maria Rilke, "change for the person who becomes solitary." These sensations have been described by the ascetics of early Christianity, by Buddhist monks, by transcendentalists and shamans, by Russian Startsy and Japanese Hijiri, by solo adventurers, by Native Americans and Inuits reporting on vision quests. "I become a transparent eyeball," wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson in Nature. "I am nothing. I see all." Lord Byron called it the feeling infinite. Jack Kerouac in Desolation Angels, the one mind of infinity. The French Catholic priest Charles de Foucault, who spent 15 years living in the Sahara Desert, said that in solitude, one empties completely the small house of one's soul. Merton wrote that the true solitary does not seek himself, but loses himself. This loss of self was precisely what Knight experienced in the forest. In public, one always wears a social mask, a presentation to the world. Even when you're alone and look in a mirror, you're acting, which is one reason Knight never kept a mirror in his camp. He let go of all artifice. He became no one and everyone. The past, the land of wistfulness, and the future, the place of yearning, seemed to evaporate. Knight simply existed, for the most part, in the perpetual now. He does not care if people fail to understand what he did in the woods. He didn't do it for us to understand. He wasn't trying to prove a point. There was no point. "You're just there," Knight said. "You are." Tenzin Palmo, who was born Diane Perry near London, was only the second Western woman to become a Tibetan Buddhist nun. Long retreats are still commended in Buddhism, and the current Dalai Lama wrote that a life of seclusion is the highest form of spiritual practice. Palmo felt immensely drawn to solitude, and in 1976, when she was 33 years old, she moved into a remote cave in the Himalayas of northern India. She ate one meal a day, supplies were occasionally delivered to her, and lived through intense high alpine winters, spending most of her time meditating. A 7-day blizzard once blocked her cave entrance, threatening asphyxiation. Palmo remained in the cave for 12 years. She never once lay down. She slept sitting up, inside a small wooden meditation box. Her solitude, she said, was the easiest thing in the world. Not for a moment did she want to be anywhere else. She overcame all fear of death, she insisted, and felt liberated. The more you realize, the more you realize there is nothing to realize, she said. The idea that there's somewhere we have got to get to and something we have to attain is our basic delusion. The British naturalist Richard Jefferies spent much of his short life, he died of tuberculosis in 1887 at age 38, walking alone in the woods of England. Some of his ideas seemed to parallel Knight's. Jefferies wrote in his autobiography, The Story of My Heart, that the type of life celebrated by society, one of hard work and unceasing chores and constant routine, does nothing but build a wall about the mind. Our whole lives, Jefferies said, are wasted traveling in endless small circles. We are all chained like a horse to an iron pin in the ground. The richest person, Jefferies believed, is the one who works least. Idleness, he wrote, is a great good. For Jefferies, like Knight, the desire to be alone was an irresistible tug. My mind required to live its own life apart from other things, wrote Jefferies. In solitude, he said, he could ponder ideas that allowed him to go higher than a god, deeper than prayer. There was nothing greater than to stand alone, bareheaded before the sun, in the presence of the earth and air, in the presence of the immense forces of the universe. But isolation has a razor's edge. For others, for those who do not choose to be alone, for prisoners and hostages, a loss of one's socially created identity can be terrifying, a plunge into madness. Psychologists call it ontological insecurity, losing your grip on who you are. Edward Abbey, in Desert Solitaire, a chronicle of 2 6-month stints as a ranger in Utah's Arches National Monument, said that being solitary for a long time and fully attuned to the natural world means risking everything human. Those who fear this will feel only loneliness, the pain of social isolation, rather than experiencing solitude, which can be by turns exhilarating and turbulent. I was never lonely, said Knight. He was attuned to the completeness of his own presence, rather than to the absence of others. Conscious thought was sometimes replaced with a soothing internal humming. Once you taste solitude, you don't grasp the idea of being alone, he said. If you like solitude, you're never alone. Does that make sense? Or is that one of those koan thingies I'm doing again? In an attempt to gain some empirical understanding of solitude, a cognitive neuroscientist at New York University placed more than 20 Buddhist monks and nuns inside magnetic resonance imaging machines, tracking blood flow to their brains while they meditated. Other neuroscientists conducted similar studies. The results remain preliminary, but it appears that when the human brain experiences a self-consciously chosen silence, as opposed to sleep, the brain does not slow down. It remains as active as ever. What changes is where the brain is functioning. Language and hearing are seated in the cerebral cortex, the folded gray matter that covers the first couple of millimeters of the outer brain like wrapping paper. When one experiences silence, absent even reading, the cerebral cortex typically rests. Meanwhile, deeper and more ancient brain structures seem to be activated, the subcortical zones. People who live busy, noisy lives are rarely granted access to these areas. Silence, it appears, is not the opposite of sound. It is another world altogether, literally offering a deeper level of thought, a journey to the bedrock of the self. While sitting slump-shouldered on his stool in the visiting booth of the jail, speaking of his inner voyages, Knight seemed to be in an introspective mood. I wondered, despite his aversion to dispensing wisdom, if he'd be willing to share more of what he learned while alone. People have been approaching hermits with this request for thousands of years, eager to consult with someone whose life has been so radically different. James Joyce wrote in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man that a solitary person is able to tap into the wild heart of life. Responses from hermits have often been elusive. Tenzin Palmo, pressed for her conclusions about living silently in a cave for a dozen years, said only, "Well, it wasn't boring." Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "He that thinks most will say least." The Tao Te Ching says, "Those who know do not tell. Those who tell do not know." The great computer Deep Thought in Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy worked on the problem for 7.5 million years, then revealed that the answer to life, the universe, and everything was the number 42. Now it felt like my turn to ask. Was there some grand insight, I questioned Knight, revealed to him in the wild? I was serious about the request. Profound truths, or at least those that make sense of the seeming randomness of life, have always eluded me. What Knight had done was like what Thoreau had. It may, in fact, be the men's similarities that is the source of Knight's contempt. Thoreau wrote in Walden that he had reduced existence to its basic elements so that he could live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. Maybe, I thought, Knight would talk about the marrow. He sat quietly, whether thinking or fuming, or both, it was hard to tell. But he eventually arrived at a reply. It felt like some great mystic was about to reveal the meaning of life. "Get enough sleep," he said. He set his jaw in a way that conveyed he wouldn't be saying any more. This was what he'd learned. I accepted it as truth. Chapter 23. Conscious of time's flow or not, Knight was still subject to its laws. He grew older. His survival skills peaked. His efficiency was honed, but like an athlete in decline, his body could not keep pace. For a while he was able to haul 2 propane tanks on his back. Then he could carry only 1. His eyesight was a constant concern. He'd had poor vision since his youth and was obsessive about protecting his eyeglasses. "I knew if I broke my glasses, that would be it," he said. "And that carefulness extended to my whole body." Then, without humor, his preferred way of framing a quip, he added, "No cartwheels over boulders for me." Even so, the world beyond an arm's length gradually lost focus. His glasses eventually failed him, and everything in the woods became more or less a blur. Each time he saw a pair of glasses during a break-in, he tried them on, but he never found a better prescription. He'd always used his ears more than his eyes, so by the time he couldn't see well, it didn't matter much. He was in his home territory.
"Do you need glasses to move about your home?"
"No,
I didn't either."
Most hermits across history, secular ones especially, did not grow old in seclusion. They waited until they were already fairly old, with a stockpile of experience and wisdom, to leave the world. Knight vanished at 20, and never again received a word of guidance or instruction. He turned to no elder for advice. He was king and janitor of his tiny realm, and the rest of the world, he believed, had nothing to teach him, no wonder to offer. His decisions were purely his own. He sacrificed college, a career, a wife, children, friends, vacations, cars, sex, movies, phones, and computers. He had never in his life sent an email or even seen the Internet. His milestones were less significant. Knight switched at some point from drinking tea to coffee. Classical music, he eventually realized, soothed him more than rock did. His pet mushroom grew. The handheld game players he stole got smaller and better. He knew, even with blurry vision, when each bald eagle pair nesting in his forest had hatchlings. He began to drink more alcohol. He fell a couple of times, hard, though never broke a bone. Once he slipped on some ice and banged his left arm so badly he couldn't pick up a cup for a month, but that was the worst injury he sustained. As he aged, the usual bruises on his hands and wrists from living outdoors seemed to linger. They didn't heal the way they used to. His teeth constantly hurt. Questions crept into his mind. He wondered if all the sugar he was eating was making him diabetic. He thought about cancer or the possibility of a heart attack, yet he did not consider seeing a doctor. He accepted his mortality as is. His thieving raids became considerably more challenging as cabin owners upgraded locks and installed security systems that were far more complex than any he'd dealt with during his brief time in the workplace. Surveillance cameras became both difficult to incapacitate and widely used. And despite his fanatical caution on his thieving raids, during which the primary rule was never to break into an occupied cabin, the law of averages began to catch up with him. He finally experienced what he called an anomaly. Or maybe he got a touch sloppy or overconfident after so many hundreds of successes. One midweek summer evening in 2012, Kyle McDougall, whose family has owned property on North Pond for generations, decided to stay alone at the family's cabin. McDougall was 20 at the time and had heard hermit stories all his life. His grandfather especially liked telling them. McDougall was working for a fiber optics firm, driving around in a big company truck that couldn't fit on narrow roads, so he left the rig some distance away. It was probably the only time in his life, McDougall says, that he didn't park a vehicle in the cabin's driveway. He crawled into a sleeping bag in the cabin's upstairs loft. "I wake up, and I hear someone on the stairs, and I see a flashlight," recalled McDougall. He shouted a greeting and got no response, and knew right away it wasn't a family member showing up in the middle of the night. "I didn't have a flashlight, or a knife, or a gun, and I'm trapped upstairs, so my immediate thought was to scare him, so I yelled, 'Get the hell out of here!' plus a whole bunch of swear words, shouting at the top of my lungs. With this, the intruder immediately retreated, or maybe tumbled down the stairs. It was, 'Bang, bang, 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 bang,' said McDougall, and fled out of the cabin." McDougall never saw the trespasser, but he noted that the screen was popped out of one of the cabin's windows and propped against a wall. I was obviously very freaked out. I called the police, but there wasn't a heck of a lot they could do. Knight felt terrible about the incident.
"I hate to think that I scared someone like that," he said. "That really bothers me."
As Knight aged, the population of North Pond gradually increased. A few more homes built or expanded each year, families growing, more people in the forest. Knight was alert for unusual sounds. He often heard hikers, but not too near his camp, and on those rare occasions when he sensed a person while he was moving through the trees, he had plenty of time to dash away and quietly hide. Except once. It was during the day, sometime in the 1990s, before he began walking almost exclusively at night and never on trails. He was on a lightly traveled path and came around a bend, and with no advance warning, there was someone else. Knight can't say what the hiker looked like. He made no eye contact. He tried to put on a nonchalant face, but he felt panicky. Neither man stopped. Knight said,
"Hi,"
and the man said, "Hi," and they continued on their separate ways. This was his only encounter for more than 20 years. Then, during a cold winter day, while Knight was ensconced in his camp, he heard a group of people in the forest, post-holing through the snow. The steps grew louder and nearer, tree branches snapping like firecrackers, Knight's distress rising until he made the decision to step out of his camp and assess the situation. He didn't want to be seen, but he couldn't risk anyone stumbling upon his home. He walked a dozen quiet steps, and there they were, breathing heavily in the crisp air. Three men, three generations of the same family, son, father, and grandfather, tromping happily through the woods after a day of ice fishing. "Knight ducked down," he said, but it was too late. He'd been spotted. According to Knight, one of the men shouted, "Hey!" Knight stood. He had on a black ski cap and a blue jacket over a hooded sweatshirt and was clean-shaven. The father, Roger Bellavance, held up his hands, one clutching a pair of binoculars, demonstrating that he had no gun. Knight's hands had been in his pockets, but he pulled them out. He showed that he had no weapon either.
"I tried to convey the idea that I was harmless, no threat, using only my hands. I did not come close to them."
Knight insisted that he did not speak a word.
"I communicated non-verbally,"
though the Bellavances recalled him mumbling a few phrases. The grandfather, Tony Bellavance, sensed immediately that they'd encountered the North Pond Hermit. He knew the legend. He realized that cabins had been robbed. But in the presence of the hermit himself, Bellavance, who was convinced that the hermit was a military veteran, was struck with a very strong idea of what needed to be done.
"He said we had to leave him alone," recalled the father.
"He said that he's not hurting anyone. He's up here for a reason," he said, "and he doesn't want to deal with people." My father's a little Frenchman with a big heart, and he just thought this guy needed to be on his own, unbothered. The son and father did not want to go against the grandfather's wishes, so they did what he asked. The three men all promised out loud that they would let the hermit be.
"We made an oath," said the grandfather. "We swore we would never say anything."
The hermit nodded. Then, his arms still held out, palms open, as if ready to catch a beach ball, he leaned forward at the waist and bowed before the three men.
"I don't know why I bowed," said Knight. "To convey the idea of thanks, I think."
The entire encounter lasted no more than a couple of minutes. The ice fishermen kept their promise, though Roger, the father, did tell his wife, who was unsure whether he was speaking the truth. No one took a photo or video. Rogers said that later he had to fight the urge several times to return to the woods and try to talk to the hermit. But he respected Knight's privacy. The men said nothing until after Knight was arrested. Then Roger, thinking he might be able to help law enforcement find the campsite, told Trooper Vance the story. She didn't believe it. Knight said that he hadn't mentioned this incident with the ice fishermen to anyone because he felt that their pact remained in place. The agreement, the way he understood it, was that no one would ever say anything. But I'd just informed Knight during a visit in the county jail, our seventh one in 8 weeks, that the Bellavances had, in fact, spoken to others about it. Knight now felt that the pact was broken. "What about other pacts?" I asked. "Did more people find you?"
"No, there were no other encounters," Knight swore.
People had been looking for him for years. If there had been any hint that anyone had found his site, word would have spread in a flash.
"Will you make a pact with me that you're not covering up any others?"
"Yes."
The ice fisherman encounter seemed like just the sort of event for which Knight had established his emergency cache. He could have abandoned his camp well before the men saw him and moved somewhere else. Or he could have decamped immediately after. He said he seriously thought about evacuating, but there was a lot of snow.
"To move, I'd have to leave footprints. I had little food. I took a chance they were good people."
Also, Knight admitted, the notion of starting over seemed exhausting. Had he been younger, he almost certainly would have moved. This was when he understood, he said, that
the circle was closing in.
Just 2 months after seeing the ice fishermen, as the snow was receding and the chickadees had started to sing, with his food supplies nearing zero, Knight departed on a midnight thieving raid. He pried open a rear door of the pine tree dining hall. He filled his backpack and stepped out, and was suddenly blinded by a light while someone yelled at him to get on the ground. Chapter 24. The ice fisherman did not believe that Knight deserved to be jailed.
"If I had $1 million," said the grandfather, Tony Bellavance, "I'd buy 100 acres, 200 acres, and I'd put him right in the middle and put posted signs around and let him live like he wants."
Bellavance, who is in his 70s, owns a home in the area, but he was never a victim of Knight's crimes. Harvey Chesley, the facilities director of the Pine Tree Camp, which suffered by far the most losses, had similar feelings. "I always thought that if I caught him in the act, I might let him go," said Chesley. "It was frozen lasagna and a can of beans, not earth-shattering. He was a thief of necessity. He has my respect." Lisa Fitzgerald, the owner of the property where Knight camped, said the discovery that a stranger had lived on her land for decades was
nothing to be upset about.
If she'd found him, she said, she might not have called the police or even evicted him. Locals who recognized Knight's story as truth tended to have gentle reactions. They said that Knight's feet stirred the imagination. At the end of a serene weekend on North Pond, you can't help but envision quitting your job and remaining there for life. Everyone dreams of dropping out of the world once in a while. Then you get in the car and drive back home. Knight stayed. Yes, he repeatedly broke the law to sustain his escape, but he was never violent. He did not carry a weapon. He didn't even want to see anybody. He was a compulsive introvert, not a hardened criminal. He followed a very strange calling and held true to himself more fully than most of us will ever dare to. He clearly had no desire to be a part of our world. A couple of residents pledged to provide Knight with land to live on.
Let's hold a fundraiser, others suggested, and give him enough cash to purchase several years' worth of groceries, so he won't need to steal.
He should immediately be released from jail and allowed back into the woods. He never harmed anyone.